welcome to a special presentation of Everything Home, the transformational show where we talk about life, stuff, and balance, and showcase good people doing good business and good things. This is our signature segment, The Massey Memo, with our expert contributor, Robert Massey, attorney, solution provider, and protector of the people at Massey and Massey Attorneys at Law. Robert delivers The Massey Memo on the first and third Fridays of every month. His engaging and entertaining personality gives the boring law just the jolt it needs to make you want to tune in and learn to better play the hand you've been dealt in this game we call life. Enjoy the show. Everything Home, the transformational show where we talk about life, stuff, and balance. We're a resource and community that shares stories, lets passions be heard, and showcases good people doing good business and good things. We've created a platform where you can do something to change your life or the life of another person, where thoughts, passions, and emotions are given an action that actually becomes a reality and makes a difference. It's a place where the community can learn from and support its own members. We deliver authenticity, celebrate heroes, and bring together a like-minded audience. The mission of our movement? Enhance the quality of your life. All of our guests and experts' information and their shows are listed on our website, everythinghometalkshow.com. We encourage you to check it out and begin to use it as a resource to meet, hire, and learn from good people doing good business and good things. Just click anywhere on their banners and enjoy the show. You can also listen and subscribe to Everything Home on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, and Blog Talk Radio. We're making it very easy and convenient for you to listen to us and enhance the quality of your life. And remember to like and follow Everything Home on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This is our expert contributor segment, The Massey Memo, with Robert Massey, attorney, solution provider, and protector of the people at Massey and Massey Attorneys at Law. Robert will be delivering The Massey Memo on the first and third Fridays of every month. Today's show is a very special one to me since we're going to be celebrating what an amazing country this is and why we need to preserve its true foundation. And on a recent interview, which we'll bring up later in the show with Ken Langone, the founder of Home Depot, they're celebrating their 40th anniversary this month. He said, when you change the structure of what we are as a nation, it's a risky game. Like I said, we'll get into that in a little bit later in the show. It's very relevant to what's going on now. So our topic, the 4th of July, is much more than barbecue and beer. Happy birthday, USA. So first my joke, then on with the show. How come there's no knock-knock joke about America? Because freedom rings. Oh, you know, these jokes crack me up more than they do anyone else. So I guess that's, at least I know that I laugh in my own head as I put them together. And then the second one, because it was appropriate. Where was the Declaration of Independence signed? At the bottom. It's so stupid, but it's funny. So funny. How are you, Mr. Robert?
I am hanging in there. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, the sad thing is about this show is a good amount of what I did for research was the first time I had read it. Yeah, we'll bring that up a little bit later on, but we didn't learn this in school, and if we did, it was very brief. I did see the musical 1776, so I did get some information there that I said, oh my God, I didn't learn this in school, and I can't believe we didn't spend a whole year on that type of history for the country. And so I did learn a lot, and this was the first time that I actually read the Declaration of Independence, and I am 46 years old, so that is sad, considering how patriotic I say that I am, but I never read the document. So,
hey, I mean, I'm sure you're certainly not the only one. It's funny you said musical because I don't know if you've seen the musical Hamilton. I kind of became obsessed with that show for a little while, and it kind of led me back into just looking stuff up and getting back into kind of the history of America and reading more books about it. And But I think similarly, yeah, I mean, I probably learned a little bit of it in school. You learn the basics and you remember the bullet points. And but, you know, when you're a kid and at the time, the age you're learning those things at, it's kind of the last thing you want to hear about. I don't, you know, you're like, I don't care about this. You don't really kind of grasp the importance of it at the time. But, yeah, and then in the past few years, I've kind of reintroduced myself to it in a way and become much more interested in it and read a lot more books about it and in a lot more detail. So it's just funny how something random like a musical will kind of reintroduce you to something like that. And it's, you end up learning a lot of very interesting things and things you never knew, and kind of makes you appreciate the country even more. And it,
oh,
it definitely does. I shouldn't
agree. Well, it's because we're so entertainment oriented that it takes people singing and dancing on a stage for us to learn something that when you actually understand the story or read the story, it's very interesting when you don't necessarily need the singing and dancing, but it gets you to the event. So then you can learn, like, we have to be lured in, like, I know, you know, we have to have, like on a fishing pole, there has to be really something nice on the end of that hook. We need to see something shiny in order to catch our attention, because for the most part, I think we are brainwashed not to care or to pay attention, which is, you know, it's a shame. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the history part, you know, I obviously have read through the Constitution, read through the Bill of Rights, in a lot more detail than, you know, the normal person, just because I had to take 2 semesters of constitutional law. And so, I mean, you have to in law school kind of read the Constitution, have an understanding of it. But the more interesting part of it is when you get into those stories and just how the country was developed, that's the stuff that really can become very interesting. But you're right. I mean, trying to say, hey, read this book about this subject is not going to be anywhere near as appealing as, hey, you'll go watch this show where these people sing and dance about it. And but it's just the way we are, unfortunately. But hey, it got me there, so that's good.
Yeah, see, that's at the battle. So you showed up, right? Isn't this all about showing up? You showed up, and then you became entertained, and you were engaged, and then you started doing some reading and remembering those days of law school. So then you probably had to have a cocktail or two. So I'm not sure if it was overall, it was a good thing. Just a little, maybe you start twitching a little, like, oh my God, I'm back in school. Ah, you know, one of those.
Yeah. The Constitution isn't it's not a thrilling read, that's for sure.
But no, and that part, yeah, that part would be like a little boring and logistics and, dry, but the actual stories behind how we got there, and that's the stuff that we should have learned in school, or if we did. I think, I just remember the one history teacher I had, I didn't like him, and he was so boring, and he was mm-hmm. just, he made it worse. But yet, if you would have just had somebody that actually was a little bit more animated, or perhaps didn't think that they were so honorary and superior to the younger students who are 20 years younger than him, because of course, you know, he's some scholar. I mean, really, dude, I'm a freshman. That got me afraid.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I think that there are so many ways that they could make it more and engaging, because once you get a chance to understand the stories, it makes a bigger difference. And I grew up in New Jersey, yeah. And there was many, many places in New Jersey and in that area where there are historic parks and what are they called? Commemorative sites. Jeez, I even wrote it mm-hmm. down. You think I would look at my own notes? So they, you know, we went, one of the streets in my town was Washington Valley Road. Well, that's where Washington took his troops. And we did the Delaware Water Gap, where Washington crossed the Delaware. So there was, at least back east, you have the ability in school to travel to some of these as part of your class trips. And I was thinking of that, you know, it brought back a lot. I'm like, God, we went there and we went there. So at that point, you didn't really pay attention, like you said, because we're in school and everybody's literally just playing grab ass when they're out for the day.
Yeah.
You know, so you're not listening to the lady who's dressed in, you know, the colonial gear So, you know, you're just playing with your friends. And so it was wasted, unfortunately. I mean, I would love to go now. But I was thinking, you grew up out here. You didn't have the ability to take a 20-minute, half-hour trek to one of these sites or parks to go to school. Or we even did a trip down to Washington, to D.C., because it was 4 hours away. To compare the two, then let's just take out the fact that nowadays they're not even teaching really history in schools. And, of course, the history they are teaching is a little skewed in different directions. So let's just pretend you and I are in school at the same time. At least we had those there. You guys didn't have any of that out here by growing up in Las Vegas and being out west, where there was not really even historic anything because everything's new and stucco and neon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we had absolutely nothing. That's why, I mean, most schools out here, as you know, a seventh or an eighth grade trip, they usually do a school trip to Washington, D.C. to kind of, you know, expose us in some way to that. But usually, you know, it's not even a class trip. It's kind of reserved for the honor society or whatever it might be. So if you're not at the upper end of the class, you're not even getting exposed to that. So, yeah, they're really, unless your parents took you to, you know, back east, which mine unfortunately did in a horrendous trip that happened when I was 8 years old. But yet you didn't have any type of exposure to it whatsoever other than what you were being taught in school. And like you said, if you have a teacher that's just very kind of dull and doesn't make it interesting in some way, it's just to kind of grab your attention and get you to understand it, then you're kind of left saying, oh man, I hate history. It's so boring. When really, now that I look back, I'm like, man, I wish I would have paid more attention. I'm extremely fascinated with history now that I'm older, and it's something that I find myself, entertainment-wise, a lot of times I'm gravitating towards something that's teaching me something about history, whether it's a documentary or a show about World War II or Vietnam or the creation of the country. That's what I'm gravitating towards now because I'm interested in it because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. So, it is unfortunate that, we didn't have those opportunities, but my parents did make sure that we got our one trip back to D.C., and it was the middle of summer. It was an absolute nightmare. My mom insisted that we all be dressed in our best because we were going on this tour through the White House and the Capitol and the whole thing. And mind you, I grew up in Las Vegas. It gets up to 120 degrees sometimes in the summer here. But that day was probably, to this day, top three hottest days I've ever experienced in my life. And I'm sitting there.
And what year was it? What year was it so we could figure out who was president?
This was right when, I believe it was right when Clinton came into office, because I was either 7 or 8, I think I was 8, which would have been 93. So it was right when Clinton came into office. And I was dying. I mean, it was so hot. I could care less about what I was looking at. I just wanted to get somewhere with air conditioning because it was just so miserable. But at the same time, I still to this day remember that trip. So, you know, maybe there was some reverse psychology going on there. But I would love to go back now and, you know, do the touristy stuff, do the White House tour, the Capitol building, go around and see all these different monuments. And just now that I can appreciate it and understand it and engage with it a little bit, I guess, is the best thing. When you're a kid, you're not really given that opportunity to really engage with it and ask questions or be able to have the comprehension to even ask the type of questions that you would think of later in life. At least I wasn't, you know, maybe kids that were smarter than me at that age were, but you know, it is unfortunate, but it's, you know, it's what we kind of deal with being out here in Vegas, and hopefully everyone does get that opportunity, but the schools do try to give everyone some type of opportunity to get out to DC in kind of a class trip manner. But I will never forget my family trip to DC. It was quite the experience, and I still to this day do not let my mother live it down that she made me wear this horrible suit and that I was almost going to pass out from heat exhaustion.
Well, I could imagine if you're not being respective of the area that you were in, whatever the tour was, I'm not sure if your mother was the one that was more mad at you or your dad, but I could just picture them both just giving you looks going, this is not the time or the place, Robert, to be acting like that. That it's just not, that is just not how it's going to go down in this family. Yeah, you do know where we are, right?
Yeah,
so yeah. I feel like, oh, that's not somebody that you should be making mad because all of a sudden, poor Robert's hot, man, you know?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It was an interesting day. It was an interesting day.
Oh, so funny. Well, I wanted to read a couple things from the history of the couple months of where this all came from, the Declaration of Independence and the two paragraphs of the Declaration, because it's very relevant to what's going on now. And like I said, I've never read any of this before. I mean, I've heard little snippets or like you mentioned, bullet points, but I just thought it was very interesting. So I'm going to do that, then we're going to get right into the show, but I think it's relevant. So the listeners, just bear with me. It'll be literally like 3 minutes, but I think you might find it interesting also. So as we all know, July 4th is Independence Day, and it's our national holiday to commemorate the day United States laid down its claim to be a free and independent nation. What I want everyone to really just pay attention to the words that they chose. And that's what really caught my attention in this. So the Declaration of Independence states, the principles of which our government and our identity as Americans are based. Abraham Lincoln called it a rebuke and a stumbling block to tyranny and oppression. And on July 4th, 1776, the 13 colonies claimed their independence from England, an event which eventually led to the formation of the United States. Now, just go back a little bit. So the conflict between the colonies and England was already about a year old when the colonies convened on a Continental Congress in Philadelphia the summer of 1776. In a June 7th session in the Pennsylvania State House, which is later the Independence Hall, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia presented a resolution with the famous words, resolved that these united colonies are and of right out to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. So that on June 11th, consideration of the resolution was postponed by a vote of 7 colonies to 5, with New York abstaining, which it just shows you that New York's been a problem from the start. So, however, a committee of 5 was appointed to draft the statement presenting to the world the colony's case for independence. Members of the committee included John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, and Thomas Jefferson. The task of drafting the actual document fell on Jefferson. On July 1st, 1776, the Continental Congress reconvened, and on the following day, the Lee Resolution for Independence was adopted by 12 of the 13 colonies, New York not voting, New York being a problem yet again. Discussion of Jefferson's Declaration of Independence resulted in minor changes, but the spirit of the document was unchanged. The process of revision continued through all of July and into the late afternoon of the 4th when the declaration was officially adopted. And of the 13 colonies, 9 voted in favor of the declaration, 2, Pennsylvania and South Carolina, voted no. Delaware was undecided and New York abstained. John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress, John Hancock, president of the Continental Congress, signed the Declaration of Independence. It is said that John Hancock signed his name with a great flourish so England's King George can read without his spectacles. And if you've seen the document, which is housed in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., his signature is huge, which the phrase, give me your John Hancock or put your John Hancock here when people ask for your signature came from, which, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, a lot of the things in history that we now find out, it is linked to something. It's amazing how it's all connected. So you're like, oh, is that where that came from? You say, yeah, that's pretty interesting. I wonder where they got that. Why do you say, is it your John Hancock? Well, that's where it came from. Those are the things that we all should be a little more aware of. So I'm going to read the first two paragraphs. And like I said, because it's very relevant to what's going on, just pay attention to the words. And then we're going to talk about some fun stuff. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, government are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying a foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. So, I appreciate everybody listening because, like I said, just the language alone is very relevant to what's going on. Any thoughts on my history lesson, Robert?
Well, I mean, I think number one, if you think about just understanding what was going on at the time for that document to be produced and the writing to be what it was and you know, more than 250 years almost later, for it to be as relevant as it is pretty incredible. But you know, and I've thought about this a lot over the past couple years, and the most interesting part to me about that wording is the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness area. And the reason it's the most interesting to me is the pursuit of happiness part of it. And it just seems like we're in a world of just big babies and people kind of, you know, it's almost like that red life, liberty, and happiness. Like he's guaranteeing you happiness. People are just walk around and behave as though they should be happy at all times. And if they're not, somebody screwed them over. It's somebody else's fault and somebody needs to pay for it. And it's right there from the founding documents. No one's going to do anything for you. You're not guaranteed this. You have to do it. You have to pursue this. And, you know, tying it into what's going on today, it just seems like a lot of people have that attitude, whether in politics, certainly, but just in life in general, how you kind of just see the overreaction to things nowadays, whether it's something somebody does or somebody says or whatever it might be, it's, well, that didn't make me, that's making me unhappy and I'm supposed to be happy at all times. Well, no, you're not. No, you're not. And it's just, so that line, at least over the past few years, has always, it has really resonated with me more and more. And even in my own life, because you get caught up in it as well, that, you know, that says it very plainly that it's the pursuit of happiness, and you're not guaranteed that. So just get on with it and keep it moving. Don't sit there and be a big crybaby about it. And I mean, especially now in the world, I think that people can really take a lot from that. But you know, it's to look at, to really understand what was going on back then and the position, you know, these people were in, and for them to kind of all come together and get that document done and accomplish what they accomplished. I mean, you look at that, and that just seems unfathomable based on today's standards of what
just sitting in a room together and having a conversation where you made some progress, whether it be just deciding what are we going to get for lunch, guys. I don't even think that they can handle that at this point, because you're just
exactly
dealing with insanity of people that don't know how to get anything done. And that goes back to some of the other shows we've talked about. And I always say that people that are in office, it's because they don't want to have a job. So if you don't want to have a job, then run for office, because you don't have to work, you don't have to pay for anything, and you don't get anything done there. So they always want to have a conversation about something, but nobody wants to get anything done. So you always have a meeting to have a meeting, and then hopefully then it's time to run for reelection. And then once you're in, you know that you're going to get a pension and all the perks, and you make some other contacts to jump in the private sector, and you're making 10 times as much money. So that's a great strategy. Anybody out there who doesn't want to work, run for office, and don't have to work.
And it's pretty amazing. I mean, you look at the action that George Washington took after 8 years, he stepped down. I mean, he could have been an American king. George Washington was beloved. Nobody wanted him to leave. They were devastated when he said he was going to leave. And for there to be term limits on the highest office, but there's no term limits on, you know, Congress, is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I just have never understood why that has been allowed to happen, why people are allowed to be career politicians, because just like you said, I mean, there's just so much, you get in this kind of stalemate, and people know they're not going to get ousted, and so they just sit there and they don't do anything, and they don't try to get anything done. And then we're just left with this system that had some great potential, but there's nothing being done with it. So that's always blown my mind that we've set term limits for if we set term limits for the highest office, why wouldn't we set term limits for lower offices as well? I never really jived with that, but I just don't like, I like the idea of kind of getting fresh blood in there and knowing you have a limited period of time. And look, everybody's got an ego. Everybody's got an ego. So if you know you're in there for a limited time, you would be at least a little bit more, I would assume, motivated just from the standpoint of, hey, I want to do something that at least somebody will remember. I want to accomplish something, whether it's for myself, my family, the people I'm representing, whatever it might be. But if they're just in there for life, it's just, oh, yeah, I'll get around to it. I'll do something. Yeah, don't worry about it. And then it's just, you know, we get what we have today. So it's very interesting. And when you look at what those men, the founding fathers, were dealt in that time frame, and you try and bring it to present day, it's like, well, we just wouldn't be here. we just wouldn't be here. There's just no way that
exactly
people running stuff today could have gotten that done. There's just no way.
Oh, God. Well, like I said, I don't even know how they even, some of them get out of bed in the morning without putting both legs in the same, putting in the same one pant leg and then falling on the floor. So maybe their staff helps them, but it's like a bunch of clowns jumping out of the car and banging into each other. And it's just a shame.
And the unfortunate part about it is...
Well, it affects our lives, it affects everything in regards to progress, money, everything. And that's the part where, you know, like you mentioned, that there's no term limits, but then there's also, there's no progress in the longer things linger without getting something accomplished, especially with just, you know, pick a topic, immigration. It is literally financially hurting every single American here. And, you know, we're going to have another show about that later down on the road, and we'll talk specifics so people can really see the dollar amounts and everything else. But, you know, it's just, we're at a point where when there is, everything now is almost like, it's multiplied by 1,000, every category, because you're dealing with such huge amounts of risk and liability and dollar signs when it comes to anything. So 30 years ago, it was no movement. It wasn't that bad, but now no movement. And all of a sudden, you know, there is like a couple more billion dollars worth of debt, and you're going, whoa, because then it's something else. And it's like, everything is just teetering right now on so many different things, whether it's people's emotions or what's going on in media or the financials or just services and states and pensions and certain cities going into bankruptcy. And then you've got bodies that are showing up that shouldn't be here, that, you know, there's, everything is just teetering. And the longer that these guys take to get anything accomplished where there is some sort of resolution and there is some sort of progress, it literally is hurting every single one of us. It's just that we're so busy working and trying to survive, we're not paying attention to it.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest issues, absolutely. And I think the biggest change throughout history, if you look at it, at least in my opinion, is these offices throughout history were pursued by the best of us. You know, the best people in society wanted to strive for that goal. And those offices, because there was prestige and you needed that. You needed to have that level of respect for knowledge and things like that. And now I feel the system and the way the system is portrayed and operates, it really discourages the best of us from wanting to pursue these offices, because they look at it and say, well, yeah, there is a lot of problems. I'd love to do something about it, but I don't want to have to deal with this. This is a disaster. And that is, to me, the most tragic part, because, I mean, growing up, in my generation, nobody I was around, and I mean, I hung out with some smart kids, but nobody ever talked about how they wanted to go into politics. I had one very good friend that I'm still very good friends with today, who's a lawyer as well, who was the one kid that always said, I want to go into politics. And now at the current state of things, and he's a really smart kid, he would be a very good politician. He would be an excellent, excellent politician. He wants no part of it. He wants absolutely no part of it. You know, my not to big up my dad here, but my dad would have been an amazing politician. He would have been fantastic.
Yeah, he would have been fun,
Yeah, and he got asked to run thousands of times by very powerful people, very powerful people. I mean, Roger Ailes, the gentleman that created Fox News, point blank told him that he wanted to run my dad against Harry Reid for his Senate seat in Nevada.
Oh, that would have been great.
And I mean, he got offers like that for 20 years. And every time he would think about it, he just would say, I don't want to have to deal with the BS. I just don't want to have to deal with it. There's just too much BS, and I would rather do something where I know I can help people, which he always knew he could do through his law firm, because he was the one in charge and he was dealing with them face to face, and he didn't have to go through bullshit channels of bureaucracy and all this other stuff. And that's really unfortunate. That is really, really an unfortunate reality that we have in the present day, because there really are people that could make an amazing difference, and they don't want to deal with it. And at the same time, you don't want to use that as a cop out, because you can't really say that and then at the same time complain about the state of things, because I guess if you're not willing to step up and do something about it, you shouldn't complain about it. But you can certainly see their point of view. I mean, I wouldn't be a very good politician, and I've never had aspirations really to go into that. But I can certainly see someone that maybe has strived for that kind of getting going and saying, you know what, I just don't want to do this. I can make a difference elsewhere. And then at the end of the day, like you said, people get so caught up working and dealing with their own stuff. I mean, it comes to a point where you just get so beat down that you just say, you know what, I'm going to take care of me and mine and hope for the best.
Because yeah.
I just can't it's just too much. And the fact that so many people are at that point is worrisome. It's worrisome, because if that's the case and you're just getting the people that are just there to kind of hang on to to tailcoats, then what are we going to be left with here? So
well, it's like the leftovers, you know, it's like the kids that didn't get picked for the team. And then they're just whatever's left. All right, you two go over there, because, we got 10 minutes before the class is over. So it's like,
yeah.
All right, well, yeah, that's I guess. Well, OK, that's great. So you don't have the maybe the people with the passion or desire, or the thing is it's about agendas. And unfortunately, it's not the agenda of getting things better for the American people or the constituents that you supposedly serve. It's a self-serving agenda, because there's too much power in it. There's too much influence. There's too much money attached to it. And just, you know, these things, now you can get a PAC, and then if somebody, you get a bunch of money in the PAC and you don't win, you get to keep all the money. Wait, what? So your money's supposed to go to running for office, but yet if they're whatever's left over, and a lot of the times the PACs are very large amounts, then mm-hmm. you just keep that. So it's an incentive to run and then just keep a bunch of the money and hope that you don't move forward, because you get to keep the money. So, I mean, it's just there. It's gotten
yeah.
to the point.
And
like
I mean, that comes
everything
from,
is,
that comes from Citizens United, and, you know, we'll do an episode on the Supreme Court, because man, you want to talk about a change over time. I mean, the change that the Supreme Court has made over just the last 20, 30 years, the change it's made is pretty remarkable. And I think the thing that people really don't understand is how much the Supreme Court controls your everyday life and the future of this country. I mean, the legislatures, state and federal, they're making laws, and is there supposed to be a kind of a balance of powers between the legislature and the judicial branch? Absolutely. But a lot of times the decisions that the Supreme Court is making, they're the ones that last through history, that people remember. People probably can't tell you, the legislative code for desegregating schools, but people know the case Brown versus Board of Education. So, and people are losing sight of just how important and influential the Supreme Court is, and it goes back to who's on that as well. Just like we're talking about people that are in Congress, you know, are we putting the right people on the Supreme Court? So, I mean, that the Supreme Court is a very a very juicy topic with a lot there. But it's interesting to see. And I hope this doesn't come off like, man, America is just absolute crap.
Because that's there's a cog in the wheel, and the cog is the people that are there. And the problem is that the United States, our country is amazing, and the potential to be able to, like you mentioned, the pursuit of happiness and the ability to have all of those tools literally at your disposal to do that is unlike anything that's ever been created on the planet. But it's just, as all the points that we've been talking about, the people that are in charge are tarnishing it, and they're making things more difficult when they shouldn't be. And I'll bring up one more point, then you could bring up one after that, and then we need to talk about some celebration stuff, because you and I can go on for days about the mess that they're making. But you know, anytime I see a politician on an interview, and the interviewer says, "All right, well, you know, here's the problem. What are you guys doing?" They're like, their responses are always the same. Well, we got to do something about it. And, you know, it's time that we did something. And when I hear that, I look up, I just need to make sure that the person that it's coming out of their mouth is actually the person who is in Congress, and their job is to do that. Like, they have nothing to do all day than actually implement something to fix the problem. But yet when they're asked, "What are you guys going to do about it?" And they're like, "Well, it's time that we need to do something." And I look up and I go, "Wait, but you're the guy that's supposed to do it. Like, that's your job description. Like, if I wasn't doing my job description, then there would be a problem. Like, I wouldn't have the job." So I just don't understand how they actually have the nerve to say a response like that. "Well, we've got to really do something." Well, you know what? If that was my job description, we would already have it done. You wouldn't even have to ask me, because it would be finished. And I know a lot of people feel that same way. So it blows my mind that that's their response every single time, but yet they're the ones who are the only ones that can do something. So I just I don't understand. And so you and the term limit, me and that response, I can't get my arms around it. And every time I started laughing. Now I get pissed. So then it's like almost, I got to turn the show off. I got to turn the show off and go listen to a fun song.
You know, look at what they've done. Look at what they've done with the people that survived 9/11 and the healthcare issues that they haven't addressed. And it's, yeah, we need to address it. Well, then
that's your job. Then what are you doing all day, dude? That's what I say. What are you doing all day? What are you doing? You're going to another meeting to have a meeting? So what are you doing? I need to know.
Nine eleven happened when I was 16. So it was in my formative years. So I mean, I distinctly remember the world on 9/10, and then the world after that, and you know, everywhere after that, it was, we'll never forget. Well, it seems like you guys have forgotten, sadly, and you haven't done anything. And if you're not going to, I mean, if they're not going to do anything about that, where, I mean, that's not a partisan issue. You're not going to, I mean, if you saw something on the news, no matter whether you're a Republican, Democrat, independent, nihilist, whatever you are, if you see something about how they passed a bill that's going to help people that were victims of 9/11 get health care, nobody's going to say, "Well, that's just ridiculous. How are we going to do that?" I mean, nobody's going to say that. So if you can't accomplish that, then
there's no hope.
Little
there's no hope
scared.
For you.
I mean, come on. So, it's absolutely. They try and pass the buck, and it's like, no. That's with you. That's your job.
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. Like, that's the part I just don't get. I don't get it. And then, but they look, they got that look on their face like, "Well, you know, I don't know. I can't, we just got to do something, but I don't, you know, it's not we're working on it, or here's my ideas." It's always, it's time to do something. But that's what you're dude, you're supposed to do that. Oh,
yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, let's talk a little bit about any special stories or anything patriotic, any moments besides the you. So, oh, talk about crybaby. I think you were the crybaby with your little trip to the White House when you were all hot. So as you were saying, people in general are crybabies. You had your moment. So at least you know, we've got to all come back down to point out our own faults. So
it was a nightmare.
I'm sure it was. Well, I've been to Washington D.C. a couple of times, but nothing amazing happened there. Like, they didn't have a premonition because I was too young. So you know what I mean. But they were always fun trips. I would appreciate it much more now. But my biggest claim to fame is I was able to meet Ronald Reagan before he closed down his office in Century City after they made the announcement that he had. It was Alzheimer's or dementia. I'm not sure which one he started with first or which one they announced that he had. And it was awesome. I mean, I went to the office. His office was in the top floor of one of the buildings in Century City. It's the one that is the most famous looking one, or it was at the time. This is almost, 25 years ago. And, you know, you're not prepared because you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. But when they put you in his office, and you're standing there, and you're, God, I was, 22 maybe? Yeah, I think 22, 23. And then all of a sudden, he pops out the door, and it's everything's surreal. You know what I mean? He looks exactly like he did on TV, and he's just standing there. And we didn't really have that much of a conversation because you could tell that there was some issues there, but he was still, you know, he was big guy, he was tall, it was just, I'm shaking. And then you're so stupid, like, you know, when people say that they meet somebody famous and then they don't know what to say, they start flubbing all over themselves and like, oh, they're like, what is your, you know, you can't even ask you what your name is and you don't even know what your own name is. That's exactly what happened. But it was pretty cool. At least I got a picture, got a chance to talk for a few seconds. And it wasn't very long because they get you in and out. But it was pretty cool. It was definitely an awesome experience, something that you'll never forget. And I get how people, I mean, extreme starstruck, where you just don't know what to do with yourself. And then you're so, it sounds stupid that you don't even know what you're saying. So, and they didn't necessarily video record anything back then, because that just wasn't done. So it would have been funny now to watch my reactions and my performance on what I said and how stupid I sounded in front of them, you know? So, but yeah, it was pretty cool. But that's my claim to fame from anything that really has to do with pro America, the United States. And he was president when I was growing up. So for me, it was amazing. We were a Reagan household. Everything was the 80s. It was Reagan. So getting a chance to meet him was just a highlight for so much that just kind of brought it full circle. I remember telling my dad that I was going to go do that, and I don't want to say he was pissed, but he was extremely jealous. And I remember him just being like, how am I not there? So, it was amazing. It really was amazing. So that's my patriotic story that I could share.
Very good. Yeah. I mean, I never met a president. Every time Bob met any president, he never invited me along, you know, for whatever reason, he never did. He, you know, he met you. I think I want to say he met both Bushes. He met Obama. I know he met Trump because they had
probably
several
interactions, right?
Yeah, no, he had several interactions. He actually gave, he was doing Hannity, and he wanted my dad in the front row of Hannity, and like gave him a shout out on national, stopped his interview, and pointed my dad out and said, hey, we have Bob Massey here in the front row. He's an amazing property attorney. I gave him this whole shout out on national television, which was really cool. And he actually wrote our family a personal letter when my dad passed away. And then I did my dad's eulogy, and I read it as a part of the eulogy. And, you know, you can kind of tell what is a form letter. Is this just something they type up and he signs off for anybody that he's sending like this? But you could tell there was somebody, not him. I'm not saying he sat down and typed this out, trust me. But somebody put some thought into it, and it was very nice. It certainly, didn't have to do that in any sense. But that was pretty amazing to see. But yeah, anytime he met a president, he did not invite me along. But you know, my kind of patriotic stories and memories really do go back to 9/11, and yeah, because of the age I was, I think, you know, when you're 16, you're kind of just starting to figure at least some stuff out. And to kind of see that drastic shift in things, but just to see how much people kind of came together and to see the potential of people and the patriotic nature of things, it was pretty amazing. And to see it and be like, oh, you know, this is incredible. This isn't something that happens in every country. To just kind of see people come together and support one another and really be there for one another. You know, at that point, and I'm sure there were similar kind of circumstances and similar behavior around other huge, you know, when the country was in war or whenever
not really.
Things like this
not,
happened or I, and maybe I would, not. And that's what I was
I'd say no.
Never,
no, I don't think so, except maybe a little bit in World War II. But the thing is that there was no communication that was obviously like it is now. So people were isolated. So maybe within their own communities, because that's when people stepped up, the women went into the workforce, people were donating tires, all that kind of stuff. But in general, I don't think that you saw that type of unity pro-America and all that other than what you're talking about 9/11, to be honest. I just don't, you know what I mean? It was just a really cool thing to see. And unfortunately, it didn't last that long.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the unfortunate part. And it's really unfortunate that it takes something like that to make us get there. But to know that it's there, to know it's the possibility, and just to see, you know, the patriotic nature of things. And I remember that, yeah, it certainly didn't last as long as we wanted it to, but I distinctly remember, you know, probably 6 or 8 months after, it still being there. And I remember thinking to myself, well, man, I didn't think it would last this long. I didn't think, you know, we would still be as united and as comforting to one another and helpful to one another this long after this occurred. And how great that was, and how out of this horrific thing that occurred, you know, I had a kid that I knew, I wasn't really friends with him in my class in high school, whose dad was in the towers and died in the towers that day.
Oh.
So, you know, just to see people gather around him, and, you know, it was pretty amazing to see. I've only had a couple times in my life where I've kind of felt that truly kind of proud, patriotic feeling. But that certainly stands out above the rest. You know, another one quickly was my dad worked with Homes for Heroes, which is a great charity that builds homes for veterans, and they give them to them for free, these amazing homes. And if they come home with some type of injury, whether, you know, they come home, unfortunately, with missing an arm or in a wheelchair, and, you know, just terribly sad stories, they customize the home to whatever special need they have, and they literally give the home to the family. And my dad was lucky enough, they had him present a home to one of these families. And I remember being there and seeing that and just being like, this is incredible. Just to have someone, this group, appreciate the troops that way and give this person this home, and to see how, you know, so the one thing that always got me was, I mean, if I see how moved my dad was, that always made a big impression on me. But just to see how moved he was by it, I mean, that was pretty amazing. So that's certainly a happier kind of patriotic moment than basing it off of 9/11.
Yeah, the 9/11. You know, way to uplift the show, Robert. Hey, give me one example that's great to you. And you're like, 9/11, really? I thought you should have started with the Homes for Veterans story. That would have been then segue into, well, the reason why that she needed the home is because she went over there to fight. And then the 9/11 kind of almost like a little bit of foreshadowing of some sort. So way to be the storyteller. Yeah.
Everybody remembers where they were on 9/11. Everybody can relate.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, but I did see that episode that your dad did. It was, I believe the lady was down in Tucson, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And so I had looked up at the time Homes for Hero, and I went, oh, wait a second. So there was one original guy, and he had a couple people that were on his board that helped him found the organization. And I looked at the pictures, and I went, oh, seriously? This is my baseball coach from the third grade, and he's still on the board. So I'm like, seriously? Oh my God.
Because
he was a guy on the stock exchange. He ran one of the stock exchanges. He was president of it. And it was always funny because a lot of the times he would be a little late for coaching us because he went into the city every day, and we were in New Jersey. So there'd be days where he was late for practice because he got stuck on at work, or he got, you know, the train was delayed or something along those lines, whatever it may be. But, you know, but to have somebody's parent, a lot of my friends' parents went into the city to work because where we lived in New Jersey. But it was when I read on that, I put all two and two together, and I went, oh, so I said, that's so technically funny. I'm connected to Bob. I'm connected.
There you go.
So much. We're on the same page. We're, you know, we have the same circles. So yeah.
There you go.
And I will give you a quick funny story about 9/11. You just mentioned everybody remembers where they were on 9/11. Well, I was here in Arizona, and I think we hadn't changed the clocks back, or since we don't change, it was 3 hour time difference, and it was, you know, whatever time it was, 5-something in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, and the phone rings, and it's my brother in New Jersey, and him and my dad were working just over the river, but they were up on a crane, so they were high up so you could really see, and he calls us, and he is not the person that what I would call to get verification of something, let's put it that way. You know, his stories are a need to know basis, and you don't need to know. So you don't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily believe what comes out of his mouth, because it could be whatever. So anyway, he calls and I answer the phone, and it's early. I was like, I gotta go work. Why is the phone ringing? So he's, Michelle, you're not gonna believe this. A plane just flew into the Twin Towers. I said, oh, Frankie, I used a couple curse words. I said, what is wrong with you? I said, you know, we're all sleeping, right? And I said a couple curse words, and I hung up the phone. And then I didn't even think twice about it, because I thought he was making up some story to just, you know, be a typical younger brother who just wanted to wake you up and just be a prick. You know what I mean? Because that's what siblings do to one another. And he's, he's the type of person that would just make up some stupid story like that. So then all of a sudden, a couple of minutes later, my brother comes running down the hallway, and he's like, Michelle, turn on the TV. And I was like, oh my God, Frankie actually told the truth for once. I said, oh, what? Oh my God. So not really a funny story, but the segue into me not believing him, because it sounded so crazy. And the person that actually made the phone call was the least likely of me to believe him, or if he believe anybody. So I wish it was my dad. I would have believed him.
He cried wolf too many times for you.
Oh, well, wolf is an understatement. But yeah, that is
yeah,
nothing.
I remember,
it was not the messenger that should have made the phone call for sure.
Yeah, I was in the shower, and when I was a kid, there was a seat in the shower in my room. And every morning when I'd wake up, this might be a little bit too much information, but I would sit down.
Yeah, say.
I'd end up falling. I'd fall back asleep on the seat in the shower. And my dad would always have to come smack me in the face and wake me back up. And so all of a sudden, here comes Bob barreling ass into my shower. I think I kind of hear him. I feel like he's going to smack me, wake me up. He grabs me by the arm, rips me out of the shower, and just throws me in front of the TV, and he's like, look at this. And that's how I found out. It was I'll never forget it. It was crazy, but it was very obviously extremely tragic, but that is when I kind of think about patriotism, and that's always kind of my first thought. So you know, at the same time, before we finish up here, I have to do my lawyerly thing, where it is the 4th of July. I hope everybody has a fantastic 4th of July, enjoys themselves with the fireworks and the barbecue and your family, and I hope everyone has a great day. It is the deadliest driving day on the roads. There's checkpoints everywhere. So, most importantly, I hope everyone has a safe 4th of July, because a lot of cases that I get come out of the 4th of July, and that's not something I really relish, because it turns a fantastic day into either an aggravating one or, God forbid, even worse, a tragic one. So, everyone, please be safe, drive safe, and just watch out and have a very enjoyable holiday. And if you do, unfortunately, have an incident, you know who to call.
That is perfect segue and promotion, but and also a very good reminder. Sometimes we all do some stupid stuff, and you never know what happens, so at least try to prevent it. And one other thing I did want to bring up for people, so something very inspirational, and it sums up kind of what we discussed in the whole show today. As I mentioned earlier, there's this great interview with Bernie Marcus and Ken Langone, the founders of Home Depot, which they founded it 40 years ago. And people should watch it. It's not very long. It's an amazing, amazing interview about two awesome men who not only have given Bernie's foundation has given back $2 billion, and Ken Langone, he's got to be just about at the same amount. I mean, he donates hundreds of millions of dollars to hospitals. I know in New York and things like that, and a lot of other things that they do with their funds. But it's interesting because it really sums up how their whole company symbolizes capitalism and how amazing this country is. And Bernie Marcus had said that Home Depot is the poster child for capitalism. And the interviewer was Neil Cavuto. And it was funny because he goes, you know, you guys couldn't get a loan. You couldn't get anyone to believe in you. You could barely put this whole thing together because no one believed that you could actually have, you could have a company, you could have a store, you could have this concept that's never been done before. You would have product that was one third less than everybody else. You had qualified people on the floor, and you had five times as much inventory as everybody. And the story on how they actually did the promotion for the first day, I won't share it with you because I want people to go watch the interview. And like I said, it's really quick. But the thing that hits home is Cavuto said, you know, it's amazing. You two guys had an idea. Nobody believed in you. Even when you started making money and you tried to get Kroger to invest in your company, a couple of their large companies, when you were making a couple millions of dollars, they still didn't believe that it would be sustainable and you'd be able to pull it off. And he said, what's even crazier is that the two of you have no handyman, do-it-yourself, fix-it skills whatsoever, but yet you created the entire industry of do-it-yourself from scratch. And it was so perfect because Ken Langone said, you know what? Only in America. And don't forget that. Only in America. And it was so powerful that you get chills. I just got chills now. And I encourage people to Google it, watch the interview. It really sums up what this country's all about. It lets you know that you can do anything you want. And that's that pursuit of happiness that you brought up, Robert. It's not entitlement of happiness. It's the pursuit. The tools are there. You just got to have the drive to go do it. So with all that being said, I think even though we did have a little bit of a venting session, and that's only because we care and we want to make sure that this country stays as amazing as it is, we just got to always remind our listeners, you know, pay a little attention, get a little involved, and we're going to try to do whatever we can along the way to enlighten people and hopefully just, you know, bring you a little more information so we can keep all the great things that we have going for us. Happy birthday, USA. Lady Liberty, bring it home. Woohoo.
Yep.
I hope everyone had a wonderful 4th of July. Promote patriotism whenever you can. Love this country. Help preserve it. It's an amazing, amazing place. Swinnick and Massey out!
Another great episode with my good friend, Robert Massey. Robert will be delivering the Massey Memo on the first and third Fridays of every month. All of our guests and experts' information and their shows are listed on our website, everythinghometalkshow.com. We encourage you to check it out and begin to use it as a resource to meet, hire, and learn from good people doing good business and good things. Just click anywhere on their banners and enjoy the show. You can also listen and subscribe to Everything Home on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, and Blog Dog Radio. We're making it very easy and convenient for you to listen to us and enhance the quality of your life. And remember to like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And feel free to send us an email or message on which topics you want to hear about and which guests you want to learn from. I appreciate you listening. Make it a great day, everybody.